Okay, Mishpatim is jam-packed, as you can see, and the second Aliyah is no exception. There are many, many dinim, many complicated, perhaps sometimes surprising dinim that are contained in the second Aliyah of Mishpatim, and we'll try to touch upon as many of them as we can, and as many aspects of them as we can in a limited time. One principle that I think you will see emerges from these psukim even more pointedly is the idea that we have a system of justice in the Torah that is complex and not always what you would have guessed or what you would have predicted. It involves a lot of different considerations coming together. But very often, the defining element is that we have onshim or consequences or penalties that are designed to bring about a certain kind of restitution, but also a certain degree of sensitivity and awareness and care on behalf of those who have inflicted the pain or the suffering or the damage that is under discussion. So as we'll see, when we go through the psukim, that this is something that will come up again and again in ways big and small, that the Torah is designing a system to not only bring about justice in society, but also to act sometimes preventively, that if we're aware that there is a certain consequence and a certain impact, then that should affect how we behave. And also, through that, to address character issues that could lead us down a dangerous path. And this is very powerful, and it's even more to the core of things when we are in the situation that we're in, where the whole world is unfortunately b'sakana, and we bear a tremendous amount of responsibility for taking care in how we act and how we behave, and the recognition of how that impacts everyone around us. So our parsha and this Aliyah specifically calls great attention to that. And it's a message we know that even after a year, we see we haven't fully internalized. And to ponder some of the dinim that we'll see in this Aliyah and what it tells us about just how careful we have to be is a very sobering message and one that we still need to work on a great deal. So just to begin with, so there's a halacha that's not really nogeya to us in our current circumstances, but does also convey certain messages of care. The Torah is talking about somebody who has an Eved Kenani, as Rashi explains what we're talking about. Kiyake ishes avdo, oves amoso vashevet, umeis tachas yodo, nokim minokim. So if a person hits his Eved or his Amma in such a way that he causes their death, so then he is Chayiv Misa, so then he has to be put to death. However, what if it's not going to be such an automatic death impact, but the individual lingers for a day or so? So, Achim Yomo Yomayim Yamod, Lo Yukom Ki Kas Bohu. But if he's able to survive for a day or two, and the idea of a day or two, so here Chazal explained that if we know a day, then all the more so we know 2 days. So why does it need to say a day or two? So a day or two is a way of conveying that what we mean is a day, me'es la'es, an exact 24-hour day. So if he's able to survive for more than 24 hours, so then that takes it out of this category of chi of misa, and the Torah has this language, ki kas bahu, because he is his mammon. So what exactly all of that means, what exactly is going on here, is, as you can imagine, a subject of much intense analysis. And it seems that here, this is an example of the Torah trying to convey the need for extreme care. That if you have somebody who has an eved, and therefore may feel he's entitled to discipline the eved, so even if that's the case, he still has to be very, very careful not to inflict actual harm on the Eved, and that if he were to kill him, so then he would be Chayiv Misa, and if he were to do so in such a way that could have seemed like it's part of a normal disciplinary effort, but was so brutal that it actually took the life of this Eved. So then that's also a situation of murder, is what the Torah is highlighting for us. So there is a lot to decipher and a lot to unpack. The Rambam in Hilchos Ritzeach notes that the Torah is specifically talking about a shevet, about the type of stick that's used normally for disciplining, and that's where you could have the question that, okay, it's only if it was an extreme kind of usage that caused death right away, that would be called Ritzicha, but if it lingered, then it's not necessarily outside the bounds of what that stick is used for. In fact, some of the Mefarshim point out that if it does cause immediate death, so then that's worse, because if a person used a weapon that's meant to kill, like a sword, so then okay, so then we understand the impact of that would be to kill somebody. But to use a stick that's not meant to cause such harm, and nonetheless to inflict death on somebody, must convey that there is an unusual amount of cruelty and brutality taking place. And if that's the case, so then it's even more deserving of punishment. But we don't have a way for it to be more, so it's equal, but it's within that category for sure. But the Rambam points out in Hilchos Ritzeach that if the Baal did use an actual murderous weapon, such as a sword, so then he'd be chayiv misa, even if it did take a longer time. And then this idea of Yom Yomayim is taken together with the idea that it's a shevet, that it's a tool that's not necessarily expected to inflict death. So if it inflicts death right away, we know that there's for sure something brutal and needing of punishment in this circumstance. But if it takes a while, so then it's no longer clear that this is a consequence of this act. But if the tool that was used was a sword, was an actual murderous weapon, so then it wouldn't matter if it took a few days. As the Maharam Shik notes, that when using a tool like that, so then it's a killing strike right away. So therefore, the liability is going to be incurred at that initial moment, even if it takes a while. But here, if it was a tool of discipline, so then one could make the case that it started beheter and that the consequences are different. But the Nativ makes that point that we were just saying, that if he does use a stick, that it causes immediate death, so then that's even worse, because it means that it's of unusual brutality. And also, he suggests that the language of the Torah of Nekama, of a particularly harsh way of referring to the consequence, reflects that, and also that the one doing it had to have acted not just out of some kind of heat-of-the-moment anger, but some kind of feeling that he's justified in acting that way, and that is particularly disturbing, that is particularly brutal, and that's something that has to be acknowledged with particular severity. There's an interesting comment Tosus has in Maseches Makos, where he quotes Mechilta, that asks the question that's a kula part of this, the idea that if the impact doesn't happen for more than a day, then that indicates that it's not a situation of Chiyuv Misa. So Tosus quotes the question that's true anyway, so why do we need to have this taught to us specifically in the context of an Eved? It's true by Ibn Charon also. So you know Kal Homer is true here. So Tosus invokes the principle of Ein Onshin Min Hadin, that we can't use Kal Homers when it comes to a Chiyuv Misa. Tosus quotes that from the Mechilta. So Tosus asks the question on that. It's a very unusual application, because normally when you mean Ein Onshin Min Hadin, you mean that you can't derive from a Kal Homer to punish someone. So here, we're saying that you can't use the Kal V'chomer even to derive the Kula part of it, to factor in when the punishment doesn't happen. It's a very unusual application. It's also suggests, well, it still affects, even in a roundabout way, it affects Dina Fashos, because what if somebody wants to kill somebody who's coming at him this way? Someone's coming at you with a stick, and they're trying to hit you in a way that's not necessarily going to kill immediately, but it could have a lingering, protracted effect. So the question of whether that person is a rodeif or not is going to be a matter of dinei nefashos. And therefore, he assumes maybe that's what we're talking about when we say ein onshin min hadin. So Rabbi Svengel in his Sefer Lekach Tov has a long discussion about this as far as how exactly we understand this principle of ein onshin min hadin. The Kotzker Rebbe notes that if a person does hit with such a strong zetz that it has an immediate effect and that the effort is killed right away, so another reason why that's something that deserves immediate onesh is because even the defense that he could have claimed that he was disciplining the Eved, he really forfeits because by taking this kind of an attitude, so he shows that he is being mafkir to Eved, he shows that he's not interested in being his bailum anymore. So therefore, all the more so, there is a extra element of asarius here and of indefensibility, and the onesh is even more appropriate. And there's a fascinating point that the Lutzker Rav makes in his Oznayim LaTorah, and Rishon Shnefal Hirsch also makes, that the idea that Beis Din has to take action against this Adon is a reflection of the fact that normally a person who was killed in such circumstances, so you'd have the Goel Hadam, who would be seeking to impose justice. But here, this Eved doesn't have a family, doesn't have anybody who's going to take on that duty, so therefore the Beis Din has to step in, the community has to take action on behalf of this Eved, and that's where this consequence comes from. So here again, you see a very complex message here about the balance and the need for great care, and that a person has to recognize that even if he thinks he's somewhat justified, but if you go too far, so then you're going to incur a chiyuv nisa. You could really have your life on the line, and the Torah is calling great attention to the need to be sensitive and the need to be careful. And this is something that we see. We talk about police brutality, and we talk about when we're trying to protect society and how we have to walk a very fine line. And on the one hand, we have to do what's necessary in order to keep order, but at the same time, if you go a little bit too far, so then you could bring on great consequences for yourself. And the Torah creates dinim that impose that awareness and that sensitivity so that there can be the proper balance struck, and usually it would require erring on the side of caution, and that's a big message that this pasuk is conveying. Just very much al pi darach hadrush, in a completely different kind of level of application in some of the Sifrei HaChasidus, Rabbanim of Sishcha, Shuda also has this comment in the Nachu Kidumim, that takes this pasuk in a totally different context, and says, Achim yomo yomayim yamod, lo yukam ki kasbohu, that you have some people who all year long they don't daven, they don't acknowledge God, and it's only Yom Yomayim that they do. What's that? That's a three-day-a-year Jew. They only care about davening to God on Yom, Yom Kippur, or Yomayim, the 2 days Rosh Hashanah. So that's the only time that they're going to turn to God. So then, lo yukam, that's not really going to help so much, ki kaspohu, because then they're only concerned about their gashmias. They're only concerned about their money, and that's not necessarily going to have such an impact. Nowadays, we have people who are turning to God 3 days a year because it's a greater level of awareness than they could have had. So it's hard to be so judgmental, but this is, again, it's something that's very much out of the context of the pasuk, very much al pi darach hadrush. But presumably it all starts from the question of where the person is coming from, where exactly, what direction are they heading. So that's one major area of discussion. The next two psukim also talk about something very sensitive and impactful. Let's say you have two men who are fighting, and once again, you have a responsibility for what goes on around you. If you're going to get into a fight, into a public place, so then you have to recognize that that could create great damage. And they end up hitting a woman who's pregnant, and the otzi yoda, she loses the child because of that. Lo Yehoson, but she herself survives. We don't know tragedy in that sense. So then, Anoshi Anesh Kasher Yoshes Olav Balaisha V'Nosim B'Flilin. So then, they are not going to be Chayiv Nisa for that, but there is going to be a consequence that they have to pay. So here the idea of lo yeh asan. So this, I've learned the third parak of Ksubis and other places in Shas where this concept comes up. So this is one of the makoros for the din of kimlei b'derabminei, that when the halacha imposes onshin, so if there are a couple of different onshin that all come from the same act, so then we only impose the more severe onish. So if there actually was a chiyuv misa here, so then there wouldn't be a chiyuv teshulman. But assuming that there isn't, so then there is a chiyuv teshulman. And the language is interesting. So as far as what the chiyuv is, so it says, kasher yoshes olav, that apparently this is some kind of a consequence of the father of the baby, of the husband's insistence that it has to be paid. So the way the Rashi understands it, and the Rambam, Hilchos Kol V'Lamazik, and the Ramban, that this is the idea that the Dayanim have to assess based on the Tviya, based on the demand of the husband. And it prompts the question exactly how they mean that. Sounds like the way Rashi and the Rambam formulated that it's a din and mamon, meaning that it's a straight-out restitution. And the Ramban understands, the language seems differently, that it's more about a knas, that we don't really know how to assess the mamonos here of a baby that wasn't even born yet, but there is certainly a avla here, so therefore there should be a knas, and therefore you need the bezdin in order to impose that. The Zayim, the Torah, understands that the husband is involved because he walked out here, and therefore the one who caused this has to find mechila from him, has to seek forgiveness. And we know sometimes in Hilchos Mechila that means that you have to show that you're trying to make restitution, make compensation, and therefore there has to be some kind of back and forth that has to take place in order to assess what exactly that's going to be. And sometimes the dayanim will have to be involved if it's not something that they can come to agree together. What does emerge here also is we see that even though the next pasuk tells us that if the mother does die, so then nefesh tachas nefesh, although it's a discussion what that means, whether that means the adam b'day shamayim, but there is a greater level of liability for causing the loss of the life of the mother, of the one who was born. But for the unborn child, so you see, we don't have this chiyuv misa. It's one of the indications that there is a different level of aveira associated with abortion, that even though the assumption is that abortion is generally prohibited, although there are exceptions, as the Mishnah says, that if there is a situation of threat of the health of the mother, posts can discuss, are there other possible exceptions? We know for sure from the Mishnah that that's one of the exceptions. But despite that, in general, there is an Isser, but we see it's not an Isser in the sense of full-blown Ritzicha, because we don't have a Chiyuv Misa. That's one of the indications. And we also do prioritize the life of the mother, which normally, if there was actual Ritzicha involved, we would say that it's Yehari V'Yavar, that you're not allowed to kill another person, even to save your own life. So the fact that it is permissible and required in order to save the life of the mother also seems to indicate that it's not Ritzicha. The truth is, though, there is somewhat of a discussion about this. It's not a simple point. The language, the Rambam, is a little bit more towards the interpretation that it might be at some level of Ritzicha, because the Rambam uses the language that in the sense of when the baby is causing a risk to the mother's life, that the baby is kirodes, the baby is somehow like a pursuer, and in those situations, one is allowed to kill the pursuer. So is that really what he's saying is going on here? And is that how he understands the hesed to prioritize a mother's life is the question. My father, Zichrono Livracha, wrote a book about this issue. He quoted 13 Mahalchim in the Achronim, how to understand exactly what that Rambam is going at. So it's certainly a complex point. But it prompts the discussion, so what exactly is the nature of the Isser? Is it on some level a aspect of Ritzicha, despite these details, that it's generally not Yehari V'Yavor, it's not subject to an onesh, or is it that really it is ritzicha, but it's an exception for some reason? So some understand that, like the Re'eim writes, that there's no chiyuv misa because there's no way to have hasra, because it's always a hasra suffix, because you don't know if the baby would have been viable or not. Or is it, as others understand, because it's not a full nefesh yet, and therefore not subject for all of the dinim? That's how other achronim understood. And leaves open the question of what exactly is the nature of yisur if it's not ritzicha. Some understand that it's a type of chavala, that it's a type of injury that's being imposed to the mother, which wouldn't mean that if we say that that's the case, that the mother has the right to allow it just on her say-so, because we know there's an isur of chavala ba'atzmo as well. The person's not permitted to be chovel others, not permitted to be chovel themselves, so that wouldn't create a heter. It would just define the isur differently. And some understand it in its own kind of category, like the Aryeh de'Be'eloi writes, the person has been ma'ayit the dmus, it's an act against the Tzelem Elokim, that if a person is casual toward life, even if the life is not fully actualized life, but if one were to take, certainly if one didn't have the justification, and one would come with a more casual attitude, so then that would be a offense against the notion of the Tzelem Elokim. And, you know, there are some achronim who have a formulation of chati shir of ritzicha, you know, which means that it's in the spirit of ritzicha, but it doesn't have all the conditions in order to have all of the consequences, but it has some aspect of the tamei hamitzvos of that kind of a offense, and perhaps that's why some of the rules play out the way they do. So it's obviously a very serious and sensitive and fraught topic, especially the Zman Hazeh. It's one of the most intense political debates in American culture and world culture. It's been going on for a very long time. But these are some of the underlying considerations that are relevant to this question. So the next pasuk really brings us into also a very controversial and debated territory. Very, very often quoted pasuk, and very often misunderstood pasuk. So the next pasuk in this aliyah is cited as one of the main attacks on the Torah. And, those who wanted to criticize the Torah, and especially those who want to say that the Torah represents a system that, God forbid, should be replaced with a New Testament, and represents a system of Old Testament justice that is meant to be disparaged in their formulation, they point to this pasuk and they say that this is an example of terribly harsh justice and that society has to move behind. And that's where they say the Old Testament justice, the idea of lex talionis, the idea of justice that is based on retaliation, that says ayin tachas ayin, shein tachas shein, yad tachas yad, regel tachas regel, kviya tachas kviya, petza tachas petza, chabura tachas chabura. That if somebody blinds someone else, if somebody knocks out somebody's tooth, somebody takes away their foot, so then the literal translation would be that their eye must be given in return, their tooth, their foot, etc. So that's where all this criticism is directed. How could the Torah have such a harsh sense of justice, an eye for an eye? Instead, doesn't that leave everyone blind? Doesn't that just leave the world in flames if everyone is going to just extract from the other that which they did to them? And so much that is written and levied against the Torah because of this language. But it's all not in accordance with our tradition. That's not how we understand what the pasuk means. And the Rambam writes, for example, in Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Chovel Mazik, based on the language of the Gemara, that this doesn't mean we take away the eye of the offender, we take away the tooth of the offender. It means mamon. It's referring to monetary restitution. So if somebody does cause such a loss to another person, so then we have to assess, and you know, we have a whole system of assessing how exactly we figure out what proper damages are, but we have to try to carefully figure it out and make the offender pay this way. The Rambam writes that this is, seems like it's a drasha, but that this is really halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, and that this is not something anyone can argue on, that this is just as absolute as the way we know what an Esrog looks like or what Tefillin look like, even though the Torah doesn't spell it out. So here also we have the same kind of tradition that this is what this pasuk means. It absolutely refers to Mominus. The Torah Tamima talks about the fact that it's hard to see where the drasha would come from because there isn't any extra language in the pasuk, so it's only really a remez for the halacha of Moshe Mitzinai. But he suggests that the indication that it should be interpreted that way is connected to the idea of Derecha Darcheinu L'chol Nesivos Se'ah Shalom, that we find sometimes the Gemara invokes that pasuk. It seems like in the kind of a sense of midosh atar nidrashis behind it, if there is some ambiguity about what a pasuk means, so then the notion of Derecha Darchei Noam points us in the direction that is more gentle, and that perhaps that's how we have this tradition emphasized. He goes on to say, the Torah Tamima, that the reason we know that is because it doesn't help the victim to have the offender pay this kind of price, so that would seem to be a extra harsh punishment, and that's how we can figure out that that's not what it means. That's a little bit difficult because, as we mentioned at the outset, we do find that many of the dinim here are a combination of some degree of restitution to the victim and some degree of what's necessary as a disincentive and some degree of what's needed for the kapara of the offender. So to say that just because it doesn't help the victim means it's inconceivable, that's a little bit of a questionable premise. But the idea that Derecha Darchei Noam is a part of the lens through which we interpret Pesukim, so that is an idea that we find in Chazal. And perhaps that is a part of this. But one way or another, it's undisputed, as the Gemara tells us, that that's what this means, and the Rambam's emphasizing that it's not questionable, that this is referring to a payment of kesef. And that prompts the question, so why did the Torah put us in such a risky position, that if the world is attacking the Torah and saying this Old Testament justice needs to be replaced, and we never meant that in the first place, so then why didn't the Torah just phrase it that way? And Torah Shebichtav, why did it leave us with this difficult fight to wage and to have to explain to everyone that it doesn't mean that, and that we know from our tradition that it means something else? So the Rishonim already addressed a little bit the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra and others, and that this is reflective of the idea that on some level it is appropriate that that should have been the case, that the offender should recognize that he imposed that kind of a loss in someone else and that he deserves to have that loss himself, even if that's not actually going to happen. And an approach along those lines, by the way, is relevant not just to this question by itself, but general questions of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, that when you have the Torah Shebaalpeh interpreting a din in a way that is not what we would have thought from reading the pasuk, so it's always worth asking the question, so why is the pasuk written the way it is? Why is the Torah Shebichtav the way it is if Torah Shebaalpeh is telling us to bring a different understanding to it? So there's always got to be, presumably, some message in the Torah Shebichtav also, even if it's not the way things are actually carried out, and therefore it's always a Kedai question to ask, even if it wasn't one as consequential as this pasuk, which has had so many centuries of impact. But anytime you have Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh, so it's worth asking that if the halacha l'maaseh is supposed to be different, so why does the Torah convey the message in the way that it does? And often the answer will be along these lines, that maybe in a certain abstract sense the din could have been this way, but for practical reasons it's going to be another way, and that the Torah Shebichtav and the Torah Shebaalpeh together paint the whole picture, but each one represents a different part of it. Ari, you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to ask, but doesn't that answer make their challenge against the Torah's statement of an eye for an eye more strong? Because if you answer the question of why does the Torah say an eye for an eye, saying that no, the Torah on some level agrees that it would have been just to some certain degree, doesn't that strengthen the claim against the Torah's statement?
Not necessarily, because it means that when the individual is paying this price. So we have Rachmanis, and we recognize the long-term consequences of creating the cycle of violence, so to speak, and having those effects continue forever. So therefore, as a matter of practicality, we're not going to impose it. But it shouldn't be, because we are casual towards the crime that was done here. The crime that was done here imposed a tremendous loss on this human innocent person. And the one who's guilty of that should feel a connection to that impact, that really he should bear it as well. But because as a society, we have rachmanis on him and we recognize the consequences of doing that, so we don't impose it. So that is what we believe is the perfect balance. And that's, you know, very much true with a lot of the onshin in the Torah, because in addition to the Torah Shavuot Staff, Torah Shavuot Pei relationship, but also because of various other circumstances, so very often the Torah describes an onesh which isn't actually implemented in real life. And it leaves the question that if the Kavanas HaTorah really is that way, that it shouldn't be implemented except under, you know, very specific circumstances. Like the question you could ask about any onesh misa in general. So if we do have the attitude that Chazal convey, that it's so rare, once in 7 years, once in 70 years, that you're ever going to actually implement a chiyuv misa, and the hoops are so high that it seems like we're really not interested in imposing a chiyuv misa too much, so then why did the Torah put it there in the first place? We don't subscribe to the idea that Torah wants one thing and Chazal are coming to thwart it. That's not the way we understand it. So if we understand that this is all one intent, that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu ultimately wants, so then why convey it one way and have it play out another way? So presumably that's often the mentality, that the onesh that's described in the Torah is there to convey that there is a severity here, that there was a big impact, and that on some level this onesh is appropriate. But in the real world, there are all kinds of mitigating factors, and there are all kinds of other considerations, and therefore we have to have a midas harachmanis that's going to take all that into account, and maybe very rarely will there actually be that impact. But it's still very important to have an appreciation for what potentially should have been appropriate given the context. And there's also a drasha from Rav Soloveitchik, which I believe is on YouTube. I saw it, it must have been on YouTube, that you can access. I can send it out on the WhatsApp group afterwards if you want to see it. It's about a 5-minute clip where the Rav's talking in Yiddish, but there's subtitles. So just in case you don't follow the Yiddish, you can read the subtitles. And he addresses exactly this question about this week's parasha, about this pasuk. He says, why is it that the Torah phrased the words in this way that invited so much objection and so much controversy, since we know that that's not the din ultimately, since we know that ultimately the din is it's monetary restitution, so why indeed did we ask for so much trouble by having the language of the Torah this way when it's not what the intent of the halacha seems to be? So he suggested that to have the Torah say it in the final format, say that, okay, if you take out somebody's eye, so then you pay for it. If you take out somebody's tooth, then you pay for it. So he said this is a tremendous demeaning of the dignity of the human being, that the human being who he only has one body and this is what he functions with, and to just translate it to monetary terms in the way it's phrased. So that's something that would be tremendously degrading. It would be a violation of the Kavod HaBrios of the human being. So therefore, even if that's the only way it can actually play out practically, that we're not going to remove the eye of the one who did this, but we're going to make him pay money instead, still the Torah has to convey it in such a way, and I think he's saying kind of a tzira for both ideas, first of all, that should have an appreciation, it did a terrible thing, and so somebody, God forbid, would blind somebody else, he should have a sense of what he did, and just how, imagine if he was to have to suffer that himself, and that for the Torah to phrase it, okay, if he does this, then here's the bill, here's how we translate it to a monetary sum, that itself would demean the Kavod HaAdam, and that's not the way we're going to phrase it. So we'll phrase it as the payment is going to be in the form of recognizing that this is the feeling that the individual should have. one could also maybe add to that, that especially when you imagine the economic disparities in society sometimes, so if the Torah just phrased it like that, that, okay, if you damage this person's eye, so then you pay this much, and you damage their foot, you pay this much, and you damage their tooth, you pay this much, so you could imagine that it could lead to the wealthy thinking, okay, I can do whatever I want to the poor people, and if I enjoy causing them bodily harm, if I enjoy beating up people, so then I'm rich enough, I can pay for it, and no problem. So I can just take care of it. So the pasuk's telling me I'm entitled to do whatever I want, and I can just pay for it. This is, in general, a theme that we have to be careful of when we talk about Nezikin. I think in Freakonomics, in one of the books about the impact of overly economic thinking, that they had that study in Israel about the daycare center in Haifa that wanted to stop parents from coming late to pick up their children. So they couldn't take it anymore. They imposed a monetary fine. If you're late to pick up your kids, then you have to pay for it. So after they did that, the result was that parents started coming in late more often, and they started coming in later. So why wasn't the monetary penalty a disincentive? So this is one of the major themes also in this Aliyah, the whole economics approach to human behavior. So you would think that would be a disincentive, but the truth was that no, it wasn't a disincentive because it created a mentality in people's minds that they pay for the privilege. Okay, so it used to be that if there was no penalty, they'd feel guilty about coming late and they'd make a big effort to come on time. But if they have to pay for coming late, then they start to feel, okay, so then I pay for it so I can come late when I want to. And it actually ended up making that behavior worse. So you can imagine if you apply that into this context, that if it just said, okay, here's the penalty, so it could sound, God forbid, like it's like a marketplace. You know, you could just do whatever harm you want, and as long as you're wealthy enough to pay for it, so then there's nothing wrong with it. So it's very important that we don't send that message, that we send the message that, no, ayin tachas ayin, that this is really a terrible offense, and the fact that you can pay for it is because that's the only thing we can make you do. But lamaisa, it's still a terrible offense. It's not something that you can mitigate by paying for it. And also, especially, if you think about it in light of this issue of the economic inequality, and so there's two halves of it here. So first of all, that the rich person shouldn't think that, okay, I can just do this to anybody and pay for it and fine. But also that he should understand that, no, that your eye is worth as much as his eye. That just because you're rich and he's poor, that then you can pay for his eye. And you know, people tend to say, when they want to degrade someone else, I can buy and sell you 100 times over. So you think, okay, you can just, his eye and his life is not worth as much as yours because you have the wherewithal to pay for it. So the Torah is emphasizing, no, it's not true at all, that your eye is equal to his eye and your foot is equal to his foot and your tooth is equal to his tooth. But practically speaking, that means you're going to pay for it. But you shouldn't get the impression that it's okay because you're paying for it. You shouldn't get the impression that there's a value that you can put on it that's going to make it unequal, but that ultimately the consequences that are being imposed on him are just as bad if they would have been imposed on you, and you should be aware that that's what is necessary here and that that's what this onus represents. Okay, so let's try to get a lot more here. There's so much to get in this Aliyah. I want to talk about Shkalim also. So kriya tachas kriya, patsa tachas patsa. So the whole idea of paying for a burn and a wound and a swelling. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma and Daf Chavad has a major machlokas here, machlokas among the Rishonim, that if you do cause an injury to somebody or you cause a hezek to their property, and the hezek is to property, chavala is to the person, so then you're obligated to pay, even if you didn't do it on purpose. So we have the klal of adam mu'a ba'olam. So the Gemara quotes that from this pasuk also, that this is to be mechayev a shogei kemezid and an onus keratzon, that even if you didn't try to do this, you didn't do this on purpose, but you were just careless, or even onus is less than careless, onus is really something that was an accident, so you're a chayiv. So it sounds like the general rule is adam mu'a ba'olam, the person is always considered to be forewarned, and he's chayiv for everything, even without any intent at all. So it was a machlokas Rishonim how to go with that exactly. That's the Tosfos over there, and Daf Sof Bava Kamma, Tosfos writes that not every onus, that there is a different love, there are different degrees with an onus. You know, there is an onus, meaning that it really wasn't what you were trying to do, that shogig, general, means careless. Onus is less than that, but even within that lower level, there's different degrees of onus. So there's onus, you just really had no intention to be doing this, and circumstances just happened. But then there's mamish onus gomer, where just you really had no power over the circumstances. You were just a tool of the environment, and something happened completely without any ability for you to have affected it or to be able to predict it at all. So Tosus' opinion is that onus gomer, a person is pater from. And Ramah quotes that, the Shach comments on the side, he says that the Ramah should have said yesh omrim, because the Ramban doesn't agree. Not everyone thinks that this is true. The Ramban thinks that even onus gomer, you're also chayiv, which brings up a different element here, that the chiyuvim, and this is, if we have time, let's go to the rest of the chiyuvim, Ezekiel, are also in this aliyah. It's quite a lot in this aliyah. So the idea of paying for a hezek is not always the consequence of an aveira necessarily. It's the consequence of where the Torah assigns responsibility. So it's possible that even if somebody is completely an onus gomer, so then maybe there should be a chiyuv. But others comment that it's not really so different to Tosfos and the Ramban. It's all a question of degree, a question of how you define it, because presumably there has to be really a point where somebody has no liability whatsoever. They just were in the wrong place in the wrong time. And within onus, we have to really figure out, are we talking about the same thing when we have this difference between the Tosfos and the Ramban? Is there a certain level where it's really not your responsibility at all? Or should we indeed say that it's not connected to that, and all onus is chayiv just like mazik? That's a longer discussion, but that's part of those points. So to try to get a little bit more in before we run out of time, so much in this aliyah. So then the pasuk goes back to talking about the other, the amakiyaki ishes, ein avdo, always ein amoso, the shichoso, l'chavshi shalchenu tachateino. So if, and the next pasuk was, from shein avdo, or shein amoso, yato, l'chavshi shalchenu tachashino. So if a person hits his eved or his ama, he hits them in the eye and destroys the eye, or knocks out their tooth, so then the eved gets to go free because of that. And it's interesting, there's a machlokas, the Gemara Megillah in Daf Yigimel has a machlokas, whether in general for an eved is it good or bad to be set free. And we assume that freedom is always what everybody wants, or is somebody happy to have a environment in which they're taken care of and they don't have to make any decisions and the like. So as the Rashash comments, if you can say it's bad to be set free, so then why is it, you know, why is that what happens to me? What kind of so because he gets hurt, so then he gets to a situation that is worse for him. So that doesn't seem to follow. So the Rashash suggests that everything is a question of the context. So maybe there might be an advantage to being housed and being fed and the like. But if you have an eved who hits you, if you have a master who hits you this way, so then clearly that's not good. So then the circumstances for this individual, it wouldn't be good for him to stay wherever he is. And the Sefer Al Moshe quotes the Medarchei Torah, is not just about Avraham, it's true about everyone, that people in general would prefer, they think, a life in which they don't have personal responsibility, in which they're taken care of. But the Torah is telling us that really the ultimate good, if you're able to appreciate it, is to have cheres, is to have the freedom to be able to make decisions and to be able to rise to the occasion. And of course, that is one of the major themes of Pesach and the Seder night, so a little bit of synergy on that level. So also by ending off with Tachaseno, Tachashenu over here, then Siv has a comment that we already got that. Why do we need to emphasize that? So and Siv says that even though this is also there to mitigate the brutality, and the owner shouldn't be acting out of anger, shouldn't be acting in an uncontrolled way, so that's the tamei of the mitzvah, but still it's across the board policy, so it's not going to look to the circumstances and see whether it was out of anger or anything else, but Darklal, the bottom line is he's paying for the tooth. And as Rav Shlomo Shmuel Hirsch notes, that you see that the way the Torah is trying to really impose care here is that it's a disproportionate benefit, so to speak, for the Eved, because to be set free because of this, and especially if it's across the board, so it's one thing if it's an eye, but the next pasuk tells us also if it's a tooth, so those aren't equal. So I think we would all agree that to lose a tooth is not the same as losing an eye, yet it's the same consequence across the board, and Rosh Hashanah Kol Hesh emphasizes that you see here this is also a part of what the Torah is trying to say, that you really should be careful and recognize that if your behavior is such that you knock out the tooth of the Eved, so then you're going to really pay the price, because the Eved's going to go free for that, and that's something that you really should probably want to be very careful about. Okay, let's try to get a little bit more in the time we have. So next pasuk says, "Yigach shor et ish oves isha v'meis." Sakol yisakel hashor v'lo yachel tisaro v'al hashor naki. So let's say you have a shor that ends up killing a person, killing a man or a woman. So then the shor gets stoned, and you're not allowed to eat its meat. Now, eating its meat, that's not so okay for us nowadays, but it is a discussion because mice, it's a nevela anyway, so if you're going to execute the animal, so you wouldn't think that that would be kosher meat to begin with. So the Gemara in Bava Kamma says that maybe that after the din was paskened on this animal, then you shechted it quickly. So, okay, I'll hop around, I'm losing it anyway, I might as well shechted it quickly and try to eat it. So no, it's still usher. But the whole idea of punishing the shore is a fascinating one, and the Ramban has a comment over here where he wonders what exactly is going on. Is this that we think that the shor needs a kapara, that the shor has a concept of punishment? Why exactly do you execute the animal for what he did? So the Rambam writes in Mar Nebuchadnezzar, he says that no, there's no way that's what's going on. It's pashut that way, that the shor has no sense of moral responsibility, is not subject to punishment. And maybe there's an aspect here of punishing the Bailam, that you should lose the shor that's dangerous, but the idea that the animal should suffer consequences for its moral mistake, that we don't find, that it doesn't make sense, he says. So others point out that we do sometimes find in Chazal such an idea. So for example, the pasuk says that you have a nevela, you should feed it to the dogs, and Chazal tell us the dogs deserve to get the nevela because they were quiet when we were leaving the tribe, and we have statements like that in general, that we are careful to fulfill the rewards for the animals for things that they do. So it seems like there is a concept of schar and onish for animals also. So the Otzer Plos HaTorah points to the Malvin, that the Malvin says that those kinds of ideas, that's about teaching us that we should be careful how we treat human beings, to make sure to give everyone their due and to reward them for the good things and to make sure to keep track of that. And that if we're sensitive to that with animals, we'll be even more sensitive with people. But in a core level, the idea of schar and onesh when it comes to animals doesn't really make sense. That's what the Ramban is, that's what the Rambam is saying, that it's not really a concept that exists on the actual essence of the matter. So next pasuk says, "M'shor nagachu mitmol shoshan v'hu ad b'vayla v'lo yishmerenu v'hei misisho isha hashor yisakel v'gam b'ayla v'yumas." So then if the animal is a muad, if we know that the animal already has established the habit, there's a whole discussion in the Gemara and Bava Kamma how exactly you establish this, but already it's scored three times, so already we know that this is an animal that is dangerous. So then that's a whole different story. And the level of chiyuv is much greater. And the level of chiyuv for the owner here, we're talking about today shamayim, but the whole level of consequence for the animal is greater. And this notion of huad, that he was established as an animal that's more dangerous, as the Znaim LaTorah notes that here, if it was already a negligent twice, and then the person starts to think, okay, nice, and look ahead there, so then you have to assume it's not going to get any better. And there's a lot of discussion, Sigis and Gemara later, as to how exactly we ascertain that you've reached that level, and what exactly are the implications. But okay, a lot more to say about that guy when we learn Bava Kamma. So just to, in the next few minutes, try to call your attention to a few other ideas there, because there's still so much more. I'm not sure if we'll have time to talk about Shkalim. We'll have to see. That's Shkalim, important too. But here is to skip to Lamed Gimel for a second. So Ki Yiftach Ishbor, O Ki Yichra Ishbor, Lo Yechazanu, V'Nafal Shama Shor Chamor. So let's say a person opens up a bor. So here we're having now the Avos Nezikin. So we have Shor and we have Bor. Here we have the primary building blocks of the types of responsibility a person could have for over letting his property damage other things and the liabilities associated with it. So here we now we talk about Bor. Bor is different. Bor had a little bit of synergy, if you remember the first paragraph of Pesachim. So Bor is what is in a exclusive club together with Chametz. That's the Bor versus Rabin. And chametz are the two things the Gemara says that eino b'rishuso shel adam, and asana kasev kiilu hein b'rishuso, that they're not in your property, and yet we hold you liable as if it is your property. So chametz was one of them, as we discussed, because chametz, technically it seems like we probably can't own, asur b'hana, and yet you're still liable for owning it, you're still subject to an isser associated with owning it. And here also a bor, that most of the chiyuvei nezikin for your property is about mamono shehizik, meaning it's about your property that you are responsible for, as we discussed in a different context recently, that ownership is not only about benefits, ownership especially in halacha, it's true in secular also, but the ownership which is often portrayed as a bundle of rights, but it's not just a bundle of rights, it's also a bundle of responsibilities as well, but Bleich Schlitz in his article in the last tradition, his contemporary halacha column, starts off talking about this, about how in the halacha we see that ownership also comes with a lot of responsibilities too. And so much of that is connected to the obligations that come with nezikin, that if your property causes damage, so then you're obligated to pay for that damage. So that obligation is a consequence of ownership. When it comes to the bor, you don't own it. It's there in that case the consequence of authorship. That if you open up a bor, b'rishus harabim, so ki yiftach yish bor, so then even though it's not in your property, you're still going to be chayiv. Rav Shechter often relates that in Europe they had an expression based on this pasuk that, you know, the Gemara says that the rabbinic authority in every generation is binding. And it's binding even though the leaders of one generation may not be on the level of the leaders of a different generation. So the way the Gemara illustrates that is, it has the language, Yiftach Bedaro Kishmuel Bedaro. That Yiftach, when he was the leader, is as authoritative as Shmuel in his generation. And the implication being that they represent opposite ends of the spectrum, that Shmuel was much greater than Yiftach. But nonetheless, as far as authority in their own context, in their own generation, Yiftach Bedara Kishmuel Bedara. So in Europe, they would point out that still, okay, so Yiftach may be very far from Shmuel, but Yiftach was not an Amaret. So Yiftach, still, you have to have a certain threshold of knowledge in order to be the leader. It doesn't mean that it just applies no matter what. So they would illustrate that with this pasuk. So Ki Yiftach Yishbor. When Yiftach was just was a total ignoramus, he didn't know anything. No, he wasn't a bar, he was a knowledgeable person, but he wasn't Shmuel, and as far as his level of authority, his authority was equated to Shmuel, even though he wasn't on the same level. So here we'll have to just talk about this generally. So you have here the Avos Nezikin, all of the ideas of liability for causing damage, and it's a major discussion. You learn Bava Kamma, so the first shiur in Bava Kamma is always about this topic, that here we have the Torah telling us you have to pay for inflicting damage through your property, so letting your property cause damage, but it's not clear that there is an isser of mazik. So should we assume that, to go back to that whole point about ayin tachas ayin, so if somebody is wealthy enough, he can inflict whatever damage he wants on other people because he's able to pay for it? Is that the case? It's not clear here that there is an isser involved in nezek. It just seems like there is a liability involved in nezek. So the assumption is that's not true, that it sounds like from a number of gemaras that there is an isser lahazik, and that somebody who's mazik is possible edus, and that there are other consequences. The Gemara talks about ein shliach udvar aveira in the context of being mazik. So it doesn't make sense to say that there's no iser of hezek. So the Sfarim try to figure out what is the actual iser. Rabbi Yona writes that it's derived from los igzol. It's connected to the issue of gezela. Sounds like from the way he presents it, it's a non-obvious way. He mentions this Rabbi Yona is actually in the first Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, so Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai, and the context of him saying this is it's something that we wouldn't have known without Moshe having a tradition to explain to us what the Torah means. So we wouldn't have known that Lo Sigzol also includes Nezikin, but now we do because we have that tradition, Moshe Kibbutz Torah Misinai. So that's one theory. The Stipler has the discussion in the first Siman his day from Vav Kama that it's a Kal Vachomer from Hashavas Aveda, that if we're obligated to return lost property, so then it can be concluded from that we're not allowed to cause a loss to someone's property. And those have a similar svara in terms of Losamar al Damriacha, because Losamar al Damriacha doesn't just mean that somebody is going to die. It means even if somebody's going to be materially damaged, if they're going to lose money, so we're obligated to step in and help them. So then it can't be that we're allowed to cause the damage. So there are a number of possible suggestions. The Chassam Sofer has in a tshuva, which is in line with what we've been talking about throughout, that the idea of having a penalty for Nezikin is all a consequence of values such as Lo Samar Al Dam Riacha and V'Nishmartim Lo Ol Nafshus Beichem and the like, that we have to take care not to create a dangerous environment, that our property should not cause harm to other people's property, other people's lives. And so we can't have dangerous circumstances that are set up by our property. So how are we going to stop that from happening? So if we hold people liable for the damage that their property caused, so that will be a disincentive. So that will enhance public safety if we understand that there's going to be a liability even without a desire to hurt anyone. That, you know, goes back to the idea of Adam Hamazik Ba'onas, that it's not necessarily that we're assuming that anyone's trying to hurt someone, but that we have to do better than that, and we have to be careful not even to allow any kind of danger to be a consequence of what we own. And the Torah emphasizes that with a set of chiyuvim that correlates that. And again, if we just think about how so much of what's gone on in the past year, and we're so heartbroken to see people who seem to be religious not taking it seriously, the obligation to protect their own lives and protect the lives of people around them. It couldn't be clearer from so many places, but that's what this Aliyah is telling us also, that it doesn't matter even if you think you have no bad intentions and you think you're just living your life, but you have an obligation to be very, very careful that you don't cause any harm to anyone, that your property doesn't cause any harm to anyone, and that if you do, you're going to be liable, even if that wasn't what you were intending to do, even if that wasn't your purpose. And that's one of the major themes. So the language of Elo Yishmerenu Bailos, that the Bailim did not protect, they didn't act to make sure that their property wasn't going to damage. So Rav Baruch Ber, in his Shiurim Bavakami, the Birkei Shmuel Bavakami, quotes from Rav Chaim, that that's the source for the whole concept of the Chi of Nezikin, that there is a responsibility to watch and to make sure that your property is not going to inflict any damage. And it's a failure to protect. It's not the desire to hurt, but it's a failure to actively make sure that you're not going to inflict any harm on anyone else or on anything else. That is the basis for the obligation of Nezikin. And presumably, that's also the point, that the whole idea of trying to figure out what the Chiyuv Nezikin is, and the other suggestions as well, what the Issur Nezikin is, some point to the Pasuk of Yehaslo Recha Kamocha, you have to treat people the way you want to be treated, you wouldn't want them destroying your stuff, you shouldn't destroy their stuff. And once again, the Pasuk of Derechei Darcheinom is also invoked, the Raman, his Chiddushim to Bava Basra, invokes that Pasuk also, and also Yehaslo Recha Kamocha. And some of the truth is all of these things are relevant, that if somebody is going to intentionally be mazik somebody else's property, so yes, they will be over Mishum and all of the associated issues. But what we're understanding here is that even without any intent to try to damage, there is a greater obligation to take active care, and failure to do so means there's a liability, and the liability is not always tied into any kind of intent or any kind of maisa avera other than that. So just to quickly mention the two other dinim in this aliyah, we have the din of Baba Machteres. Baba Machteres, the Gemara in Sanhedrin has a long discussion about, is one of the major sugyas involving rodef. It's also a topic that has been very controversial in American law in the past few years, the whole idea of stand your ground, and if you find somebody on your property, what kind of action are you allowed to take against them? So on the surface here, the Torah describes that if you find somebody in your house, or you think it's coming to rob you, you're allowed to kill him. But the Gemara has the whole discussion, because the assumption is that it's based on a rodef idea, that we know that people will act to try to protect their property. So therefore, presumably, the guy who breaks into someone's house knows that the house owner, the owner of the house, is likely to fight back to protect his money, and he will do what he has to. So therefore, the intruder is probably ready to kill him, because he recognizes that that's the kind of resistance he's going to get. So if the intruder is ready to kill him, so then it's a rodef situation, you have a right to kill him. But if that's not the circumstance, if you don't have that impression of the situation, it's going to be very different. So that's a very major topic as well, and it's derived from the language of these psukim and the words in this psukim, that there is that complex balance once again. And at the end of the aliyah, so you have the din of kefil. You have the din that if somebody is caught with stolen property, so then he has to pay twice as much. And if it's a shor or seh, that the tavach u'machar, so if he stole a shor or seh and he slaughtered it and sold it, so then it goes up to 4 and 5 times. That's 4 times for a seh and 5 times for a shor. And it's a fascinating scale. So here, interesting in general, that the Gemara has one way to explain this. Rashi quotes from Chazal the ways to explain these dinim. And the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, the Rambam is often an independent thinker, especially in the Tamiya Mitzvos. So the Rambam has his own way of explaining what exactly the differences are, because here we have a whole scale. So if somebody's a gazlan, if somebody steals openly, so then he has to give it back, but there's no greater payment after that. If somebody is a ganav, which means he steals in a sneaky way, so then if he's caught with his stolen property, then he's got to pay kefil, he's got to pay twice. And if somebody steals a shor or a seh, then it goes up to 4 or 5 times. So what's the whole reason for that gradation? So the way Chazal explained it is that the reason a ganav is worse than a gazlan, that a ganav pays twice and a gazlan doesn't, is because a gazlan is less offensive to God, because the gazlan just steals openly, so he doesn't care who sees him, he doesn't care if people see him, he doesn't care if God sees him, he's just a meshugana. So that's one thing. But the ganav, he is careful enough not to be seen by people, so he's scared of man, but he's not scared of God. God is watching, and he doesn't seem to care about that. So that's extra offensive to God, so therefore there is an extra knas for that reason. It's a knas, by the way, meaning that we don't have a bezin that's able to impose this nowadays. We can only impose knossos when you have a bezin of sukhim. So this isn't actually practiced in contemporary bezin, because it's a knas, but that's the idea, that this is a punitive consequence beyond the actual restitution. Contemporary bezin is only empowered to deal with restitution payments. So if you stole something, you have to pay it back. If you damage, you have to pay for the damages. But a knas, which is a set fee based on external consideration, so that contemporary bezin is not authorized to do. So here we're talking about knossos, so the ganav is going to have to pay extra because of that. And when it comes to 4 and 5 for a shorter set, so why is it different? So here Chazal has a fascinating comment that Rashi quotes, is because kavod abrios, that you steal an ox, so it'll follow you, but you steal a sheep, you're going to have to carry him on your shoulders. It's going to be a degrading position. So because the thief, in the consequence of stealing somebody's property, he has to be mavazim himself. So we have Rachmanis for him when we take off payment. You see the extent to which the Torah cares about Kavod HaBrios. It's a fascinating idea. But the Rambam has a completely different approach. The Rambam says that this is all basically an economic theory, meaning the study of incentives and disincentives. And all of this is based on how much do we need to disincentivize this kind of theft. So that's why the scale goes the way it does, because a goblin, you don't have to do so much to disincentivize, because a goblin acts openly. So if you're going to steal in the public, so you can't live a normal life. You can't then just go back to school the next day or back to work the next day, because everyone knows who you are. So you're going to have to hide out. It's not such an appealing life to be a goblin. So there aren't so many goblin in there. But ganavim, so that's a different story, that if you're able to steal in a sneaky way, and you can still live a respectable life, and you can still mingle in society because no one knows that you did it, so then we got to worry more about the ganas, so we have to disincentivize ganavim more, so we have the Indian of kefil in order to disincentivize it. And then the idea of shor seh going up to 4 or 5 times, says that's because you're dealing with property that's much more vulnerable. And if somebody has jewelry that was worth as much as a shor seh, so then they could just lock that up in their safe in their basement and put an alarm there and it wouldn't be so easy for someone to steal. But if they have animals that are worth an equivalent amount, so the animals, they can't lock them up in a safe in their basement. They have to graze some distance from the residence. So they're very vulnerable. It's very hard to protect. So because of their vulnerability, so we have to put a big knas on it. We have to say, okay, this is really going to be an expensive thing to do. If you think that, okay, I'm going to steal an ox, and then I'll quickly shecht it and package up the meat, and then no one's going to be able to hear any noises from my house because I already shechted it, and no one's going to know where to look, and it's already in the freezer. So it's easy for me to steal, easy for me to monetize, and it's a big temptation. So therefore, the Torah puts on this punishment that the Rambam explains, that therefore this is a big disincentive. You know that you're going to have to pay 5 times as much. So then that's hopefully going to do something to offset just how tempting this particular crime is. Okay, so there's a lot in this parsha to really emphasize just how much the din of the Torah are there to bring this balance between justice and sensitivity and the needs of the offender as well to grow into sensitivity and his care. And again, this is a message that we need now more than ever, literally more than ever, to our great chagrin. Shkalim also has important things to say about this, but we're out of time. So maybe on Sunday we want to continue a little bit about Haseba, but maybe we'll find some time to say a little bit more about Shkalim also, or be able to, relevant to Purim, we'll maybe mention a little bit closer to Purim, but it's an appropriate theme for Rosh Chodesh Adar as well. So I wish you all Rosh Chodesh Adar of Simcha, in every meaning of the word. It should be Shabbat Rosh Chodesh Adar of Simcha, of safety, of health, of inspiration, of elevation, of Chesed, one of the major themes of Shkolim. And it should all only know good things, and God willing, look forward to seeing you on Sunday. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great Shabbat.